Get to lots of things to talk about. Some things good, some things bad. We'll figure it out as the night goes on. I'm going to talk about the low wage economy here in the U.S. How's it working for everybody? You know, some new numbers coming out saying, well, if you're a low wage worker and you happen to be female, well, chances are you and your child are in poverty. That's the American economy. Those are the jobs that we have not unionized, organized, or really as a nation valued, in my view. We'll talk about that. And in the second hour, we're going to head over to talk about the death penalty. I've had a bunch of, I guess it was about a month ago, I had made a comment about my views on the death penalty, and I got a couple of emails from people that, well, that's because you're weak on crime. And I don't know how saying I don't believe in state-sponsored murder is somehow weak on crime, but we'll delve into that. A case here recently, a Louisiana man, locked up since 1984. And I was thinking about this. I graduated from high school in 1985. So you stop, you think about it. My entire productive working life, this guy spent on death row for a crime he didn't commit. For a crime he didn't commit. I mean, look, you did it. You deserved it. You deserve to get whatever comes your way. But if you're sitting in that cell on death row with people who did do those things, I would be one really, really angry guy. And we'll talk about that. Also, in the second hour, we're going to talk about what's going on in Japan. More stories coming out about Fukushima, the nuclear fallout. What's that going to mean to us? And should we be building more nukes? Should we be building more nuclear power plants? Some folks say yes. And, you know, I'm of the mindset, let's try other things first. I've heard the stories. They're generally safe until they're not. And that's my problem. It's that until they're not thing that bothers me. Also going to take your calls, your thoughts, your questions, your comments. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So today, got the email. Yesterday we talked about what happened in the General Assembly in Pennsylvania as the House of Representatives in the great Commonwealth here, in their infinite wisdom, thought it would be a great idea to pass a law aimed at working people, because there was this bizarre belief that, you know, those union people, they get special protection. They're special under the law. Because Republicans of the past, during the Ridge administration, thought that we should pass a stalking law that actually focuses on stalking. Where if a guy stalks a girl, or a girl stalks a guy, because I went through it for a while. I had someone who, every time I turned around, there she was. Now, you know, being, you know, a big guy, I never really felt unsafe. I never felt threatened. I just thought it was odd. I can see how you can feel threatened. And I am all in favor of passing laws that protect people from being stalked. What the Republicans here and some Democrats did here in Pennsylvania yesterday is they have passed through a piece of legislation of which there is really, honestly, no need. And I'm not going to point to any of my words. I'm not going to point to any union words. No labor leaders. In fact, we talked to a labor attorney yesterday at some great length about this, and he was quite articulate and quite pointed at how this House Bill 1154 does nothing positive. All it does is cause industrial chaos. And, you know, it's like anything. It's that law of unintended consequences, because there are going to be places where business, you're going to be tried to. But I get this email, and it's one of those moments where you go, there's a moment of truth, a moment of honesty that you have to give these right-wing front groups who won't tell you where their money comes from, who's funding the attack campaigns. Now, this group I've talked about before, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, and you would think that they would have actual citizens, and like a large number of them, because it's the Citizens Alliance, right? You know, all of these people are coming together for really important things. Sounds good, doesn't it? It does. It sounds wonderful. Except it's a handful of people who work in some in a very small office, well funded by who knows, because they won't tell us. And we're not allowed to know because the law doesn't make them tell us. Now, those union groups that these folks go after, we know where every penny that they get comes from because they have to report it. And this is what we've done to organized labor, to neuter it at every step. What we've done to people organizing so that they can have better wages, hours, and conditions, what we've done to them at every step is we've filled them with busy work. Here's a task. Fill out these paperwork. Let us know where you spent every single dime, where you bought that pack of bubble gum, where you got the staples from. We want to know it all. But those front groups that are well-funded by the billionaire class, like Americans for Prosperity, and, of course, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, they don't have to tell us anything. And what's odd is a lot of these groups are tax-exempt, which means we, the taxpayers, actually give them tax breaks to be able to misinform us. But on this moment, I am not going to accuse the Citizens Alliance of misinforming. In fact, they were very, very accurate. They pointed out in their email, in their gloating email, that you know, no one should be exempt from criminal prosecution. No one! I'm just going to read it to you. It would appear, they write, that the recent indictment of 10 union bosses from Philadelphia's Iron Workers Local 401 may have spurred some positive action in the General Assembly. As we have noted previously, union members are currently exempt from prosecution under the laws covering stalking, harassment, and threatening to use weapons of mass destruction. On March 12, 2014, the Pennsylvania House voted on House Bill 1154. The legislation would close several loopholes in the state criminal law that exempted parties to a labor dispute. Now, before I go on any further, do you remember what they wrote in the very first line? The indictment of 10 people in Philadelphia? Did you get in the first sentence that the indictments of those 10 people spurred this law? Can I ask a dumb question? If they've been indicted for a crime, that would lead one to believe, you can come with me on this, that would lead me to believe that there's already a statute on the books by which to charge them, try them, and lock them up. Is there not? So if that's the case, if we did get these people who threatened weapons of mass destruction, not that they could get a nuclear bomb, not that they could get any of the things that people claim that they said they were going to use, throw that aside, but just uttering the words, if that's crime enough, they're already being tried for it. So when I saw this email, I'm going, you just admitted that what you are proposing, this really horrible waste of time piece of legislation, is already a crime. It's already illegal to do what you're saying this would stop. They go on to say it should not come as any surprise when some union members act as if they're above the law, because in some cases they are, exempting anyone's violent and threatening behavior from criminal prosecution because they're a member of a special group goes against the idea that we live in a nation of laws. Let me remind you, they indicted people. There are people being tried for a crime. So I'm going, well, you just admitted it's not necessary. So why are they doing it? Again, what they're doing is they want to silence protest. They want to silence anyone's ability to demonstrate, to come to collect together. Now, it's my belief that this is another piece of unconstitutional legislation, which will cost we, the taxpayers, and this is what should infuriate every taxpayer in this Commonwealth, because they've been fighting this since last summer. This came up at the beginning of last summer, and they've been going through this, hearings and all kind of whatnot, and actually raising a lot of money off of it for their campaigns. But they've been spending a lot of tax dollars pushing this through, because it is. It's the litmus test to see just how crazy of a right-winger you are in this state so that you get the Koch money. That's really what this is. Are you on board with the extreme plan to silence people? Not just union people, people in general. Because what this is going to do, this is going to put a chilling effect on any demonstration. I know, we've got the constitutional right to assemble, right? Peaceably assemble. Yes. Now if they start calling it stalking, oh, you showed up at that place 2 days in a row, that's stalking, you're going after those people. Man, this is masterful. And, you know, trust me, you're going to get in, and this is going to be one of those things where district attorneys are going to try and make names for themselves all over, a whole bunch of different pieces of ideas. Right now, they're just going after union people. That's those union thugs who they've already indicted. Remember that. Remember when they say, well, there's special cutouts or special exemptions. They've indicted 10 of them. 10 of them are going to stay in trial for whatever it is that they did. There are laws on the books. Now, these are the people who tell us, and I have to go back to this because this is important. These are the people who tell us they want smaller, less intrusive government with less regulation and less oversight and less intrusion in our lives, except if you're one of those people who demand to have your voices heard. You know, when I was at the Capitol, when working people came to the Capitol to have their voices heard over this and other legislation, they locked people out of their Capitol. They don't want this. They really, and these are the Republicans, the authoritarians. These are your little dictators. The little dictators want to make sure that you don't organize, that you don't talk to your neighbors, that you don't come together in collective action. And if it means passing pieces of legislation like this to take away your right, so be it. Now, the other part of this, from the taxpayer's point of view, this is going to go to this will work its way through the courts. It will go to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And it will eventually, in my view, be ruled unconstitutional, much like Act 13, much like the gerrymandering, much like a lot of the voter suppression, much like a lot of what the totalitarian regime right now is pushing down our throats. Right now, these people want to take away all of the institutions that people have to make their lives better. The vote, organizing, all of those things, local action, all of that. They want to take it away. And I think if you look at every piece of legislation that they have come forth with, it's been to deny people a voice. So I say you got to call your senator. You got to call your senator today, tomorrow, the day after, every day until this is stopped. Because once they get this is just a toe. This is just the pinky toenail in the door that opens the floodgates to every other anti-worker piece of nonsense that we've seen across this country. I'm telling you, this is the battleground. This goes through, this gets signed, they put this feather in the Corbett cap. It's all over. Welcome to Mississippi, welcome to Alabama, welcome to South Carolina. Wages will plummet, living conditions and standards will go down. Unquestioningly, in my view. That's why I say you got to call your senators. Do it tomorrow. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Four U.S. postal unions are forming an alliance to defend the Postal Service. The unions, American Postal Workers Union, National Association of Letter Carriers, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, all say the Postal Service is under attack. They say a congressionally manufactured financial crisis is draining the Postal Service of vital resources, and the closing of half the nation's mail processing centers has wiped out tens of thousands of good jobs. The postal unions... You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Four U.S. postal unions are forming an alliance to defend the Postal Service. The unions, American Postal Workers Union, National Association of Letter Carriers, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, all say the Postal Service is under attack. They say a congressionally manufactured financial crisis is draining the Postal Service of vital resources, and the closing of half the nation's mail processing centers has wiped out tens of thousands of good jobs. The postal unions say that corporate privatizers have the Postal Service in their crosshairs, trying to gain control over large segments of postal operations to get their hands on the U.S. Postal Service's $65 billion in annual revenues. The Postal Union Alliance stands for a public postal service, enhancement and expansion of service, and protection of good union jobs in thousands of communities all over America. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten and teacher union leaders from the UK, Poland, Denmark, and Bulgaria are visiting the Ukraine. The Ukrainian Trade Union of Education and Science Workers invited them. They'll be meeting with Ukraine trade union leaders and government officials. Weingarten says it's a great honor to be asked by Ukraine's teacher unions to work with them to strengthen their democratic institutions and support their efforts to build a brighter future for all Ukrainians through education, democracy, and the rule of law. The battle against New York City's wage theft problem focused Wednesday on El Poblano restaurant, where former employees allege they are owed thousands of dollars in unpaid wages. Some elected officials joined workers and their allies in a rally at the Queens restaurant. Selena Alvarez says she worked at El Poblano in 2012 and was not paid for most of the 10 to 12 hours a day that she worked. She has filed a complaint with the New York State Department of Labor. The restaurant has since shut down. The Coalition to End Wage Theft said the rally is an effort to highlight how challenging it can be for workers to get their lawful pay in these cases. New York State Assemblymember Francisco Moya says businesses that don't pay earned wages are no better than thieves. He says some businesses victimize immigrant workers. Unions and community allies have organized to combat what they say is a widespread wage theft problem in New York City. The Teamsters are joining with UK shareholders in the multinational transport company National Express Group, calling on the company's board of directors to improve oversight and transparency regarding the company's human capital policies and practices. The company operates school bus companies Durham in the U.S. and Stock Transportation in Canada. This shareholder proposal is aimed at getting the company to adopt a meaningful and enforceable workplace human rights policy. The Teamsters say worker safety and worker rights need to be ensured at the National Express Group, which employs 35,000 people worldwide.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I'm curious your thoughts on this, because, you know, when a group is telling you, look, we already know that it's illegal. There are already people who are standing trial for this, but we're going to pimp it anyway. Because we know that the end result, and this is just like the paycheck deception. They know that the outcome is not what they're preaching. What they're telling you the outcome is not the outcome. They're not worried about that. They could care less. You know, I find it interesting when the corporate class starts telling you that they care, guard your pocketbooks. Guard your health, guard your children, get the kids off the street, get grandma and grandpa out and bunker down. Because trouble is coming. When the corporate class tells you they care, oh, my. So you look at this piece, this 1154, which passed. And, you know, I've yet to find anyone who can make a cogent argument why it's needed.
Because, well, Rick, you know, they threatened to use weapons of mass destruction.
But that's already against the law. And the people who voted for this voted against an amendment that said that they recognize that the language was to be just added in, that this wouldn't apply to constitutionally guaranteed rights. And the Republicans voted against it. The Stephen Blooms of the world voted against it.
You know, the constitutionalist people say we care about Constitution.
Those are the folks who voted against it. And why? Well, because they were told, this is what you have to vote for. You want our campaign cash? This is it. You want to move on to the next level? This is it. You've got to follow the rules. Follow our rules. Because we're the corporate overclass. Now, I know, there's some people saying, but Rick, these are people who are ideological. Yeah, these are ideologues, all right. Now, the other part of this is this paycheck deception that they keep throwing out here. Under the guise of that somehow it's going to protect your paychecks. Yeah, that's going to happen. They know that once they take the dues check off out of the contract, once they break the contract, once they're able to, by legal means, go in and strong-arm the collective bargaining process and steal this away, they know that the vast majority of members are not going to sit down and write out that check every month. They're just not. Because it's like anybody else. At the end of the month, when things start happening, you start going, oh, well, this falls down. And they know that immediately they give the unions busy work to go collect dues. And this is about keeping them busy. So if you can keep these organizations that represent workers, that represent the poor and the downtrodden, if you can keep them busy with nonsense, if you can keep them running after their tail, you know who they're not coming after? Yeah, they're not coming after the very well-to-do. They're not coming after legislation that would raise the minimum wage. They're not coming after legislation that would get paid sick days for folks and family medical leave. They're not going after that. They're trying to survive. And that's what that paycheck deception thing is about. It's that simple. There's no protection there. And I've asked people, I go, well, okay, you've called it paycheck protection. Whose paycheck are you protecting? Is there anything in there against wage theft? Well, no. Anything against in there, making it worse of a penalty to cheat somebody out of overtime, cheat somebody out of their breaks? Anything in that? Anything to give people breaks? Well, no. Then what are you protecting? Oh, yeah. We're protecting the corporate class. From who? From you. And from me. And from the folks who sit on top of the economic heap. Interesting story from the LA Times today. Evidently, the number of millionaires in the country has reached an all-time high. Right now, we have never had more millionaires than we have right now. In fact, as the LA Times points out, the number of households with a net worth of $1 million, or as, what was that guy's name? What was his name? The Goldfinger guy. Austin Powers. As Austin Powers would say, $1 million. Now this isn't your home or anything. This is assets of $1 million. A record 9.63 million people. So 9,630,000 people now are of that 1 million or above threshold. That eclipses the 9.2 million that we saw in 2007. Before the Bush collapse happened. Now, thanks to the Bush collapse, you saw that millionaire class dip from 9.2 million in 07 down to 6.7 million at its low in 2008. Well, now we're back up to 9.63 million millionaires. And hey, good for them, really. I mean, I don't have a problem with people getting wealthy. I don't have a problem with people doing well. I have a problem with it being redistributed from the people who make the living, but that's an argument for another day. They go on to say that this Spectrum Group, these are the people who put these numbers together, their study has pretty much reinforced this idea that the very well-to-do in our country, doing really well, everyone else, not so much. They go on to say that the number of households with more than $25 million in assets reached a new high as well. That number sits at 132,000. So you've got 9.63 million people with over $1 million in assets. Jump that up to 25 million. Now you got 132,000. Probably enough people you could put into a pretty good sized football stadium. Into a really good sized football stadium. 132,000 people. They point out that the number of families with 100,000 or more also rose to 38.6 million people. folks up from 2008, which was 31.2. So you look at this, you go, well, 38 million. That's right around, what, about 11% of the country? 11%. You know, so your top 10, and then you've got your top 1%, and then your percent of 1% above that, that control the vast majority of the wealth in this country. That leaves the other 90% of the people in this country, and really the other 99%. Which is why I thought it was interesting that I saw today there was a lawsuit filed by workers at McDonald's in three different states. They are accusing the McDonald's Corporation and the franchisees of alleged wage theft. Now, you know, we've seen study after study. In fact, there was one done not too long ago in New York City that said the fast food workers there, some 84% of them, had said in the last year they had experienced at least one form of wage theft. Now remember, paycheck protection! We got to protect those paychecks! 84% of the fast food workers in New York claimed that they had wage theft in the form of being clocked out while still working, being forced to miss breaks, being unreimbursed for delivery expenses, you know, like the Pizza Hut guy not getting mileage or getting gas money or any of that stuff, or just getting cheated out of overtime. Or, even worse, being cheated out of hours. I mean, do you remember that case here in the area where, I forget the guy's name, Chang, I think his name was, who owned a couple of fast food joints in the area, had brought kids in from other countries, under the student visa program, under the J-1 student visa program, the cultural exchange program, and had like 8 or 10 of them living in his basement, you know, like kind of like hostages. And whenever he needed workers, they just went and walk over and go to work for, you know, anywhere from 5 or 15 or 20 minutes to 25 hours. And I remember at the time going, you know, these kids did get a cultural experience. They did find out what it's like to be a low-wage worker here in the U.S. They did find out what it means to have no power. But you know what I give those kids credit for? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, I give those kids the utmost credit of saying, being in a foreign country, of standing up and saying, no. Standing up and saying, this is wrong. And I remember going to the McDonald's when they had the big rally, and we were part of all of that. And I remember going and talking to the manager while everything was going on. The insanity was going on outside. There were, you know, people were screaming at the guy who was the regional director, who just made the situation so much worse. But I remember going and talking to the manager and saying, you know, did you see this coming? And, you know, I think he admitted more than he should have. And I don't want to get the guy in trouble, and I'll never say who he was, but, you know, he said, look, you know, this is how the systems run. He goes, I'm just the guy who oversees it. And he didn't make a decent living either, because I asked him, do you make much more than they do? And he's like, I'm salaried. So it goes back to what we were talking about Obama, you know, signing this using the pen and the phone to say that there's got to be some minimum for these exempt employees. And then I talked to some of the workers there, some of the American workers, and I don't know if it's brainwashing, I don't know if it's a form of Stockholm syndrome, but they identified with the company. Oh, they just want to cause trouble. You know, we just want to do our jobs, they just want to cause trouble. But and then you go, well, can you make a living? Well, no. So then what do you think the alternative is? Are these kids taking hours from you? Well, yes. Are these kids taking jobs from other people in the community? Well, yes. That's not why they came here. They came here as a student to learn about our country. And I got to be honest with you, you know, as you look at this stuff, you got to start asking the question, how long are we going to put up with it? How long are we going to put up with this redistribution of wealth from the people like those kids working at McDonald's, like those people working in fast food or retail, like those managers who took on jobs, you know, I got a big promotion and they're making less money, working more hours. You know, how much more of it does it take for us to say no more? I guess that's my question. Because, you know, I've had people tell me, well, you know, I like my job. That's not the question. I've liked every job I've ever had, too. There have been some jobs where people have been really a pain in the neck, and you've got to deal with that. And there should be mechanisms for that. So I'm curious your thoughts on this, because, you know, as you see this economic stratification, as you see the haves and the have-nots growing further and further and further and further apart, while you've got a messaging machine in this country saying, oh, anybody who says anything about income inequality wants redistribution of wealth. And I'll be honest with you, I do. I'm not going to lie. I'd like it distributed the way it was when we had a really strong economy, when we had a really strong middle class, when we had really strong opportunities for kids like me coming up from poverty to rise up and to follow their dreams and follow their passions and follow their talents and their skill. Yeah, I see so many people right now who are kind of pigeonholed. I met a guy the other day with a master's degree driving a truck. Not because he wanted to, because that was the best paying job he could find. That's a problem. Which is why we need to have political leaders who are smart enough to look to the future and say, you know what, we can and we must invest in the future of our country. And right now, get people back to work. Seems pretty simple to me. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, from the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the development of our political color code of red for Republican and blue for Democrat. Political color coding around the world still remains generally red for liberal leftist parties and blue for more conservative parties. And those were also the prevailing designations in America until recently. But game-changing household technology appeared in the 1960s that was all about reds and blues. It was called color television. And yet, for more than 30 years, there was no standard color code. It's during this period that different sources produce different versions of the development of the color scheme. We do know that by the 1996 election, most of the major television networks had gone to red Republicans and blue Democrats. But join us again next time for the clincher. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Mothers everywhere warn children not to put any food in their mouths unless they know where it came from. The same should apply to putting information in our heads. For instance, the Employment Policy Institute has recently run full-page newspaper ads alerting the public and policymakers that an impressive group of some 650 economists who are supporting an increase in America's minimum wage includes many who are radical researchers. The Institute's message is that no one should listen to, much less respect, this group of economists. But wait, many in the group are radical? How many? The ads only list 8 and offers only innuendo as, quote, proof of their radicalism. And by the way, what and who is the Employment Policy Institute? Sounds legit, but is it? Not at all. It's a nonprofit front group run by longtime corporate operative Richard Berman. It gets millions of dollars in tax-exempt donations from fast food chains and other corporate interests trying to kill the wage increase. Then funnels that money into Berman's for-profit PR firm, which also represents the restaurant industry. To make its case, the Institute has cited several, quote, academic reports that assail the wage increase on multiple fronts. But just as Berman refuses to disclose the names of the corporate giants funding him, he also never mentions that more than half of the economists whose papers he cites are paid by him. One, Joseph Sabia, has been given $250,000 in 8 grants from Berman's Institute. In addition, an independent analysis of one of Sabia's reports found that the data was skewed to make it seem that a New York wage hike had a negative impact on employment, which simply was not true. This is Jim Hightower saying, this phony institute is a scam and a scandal. So, Mama says, don't put any of its stuff in your head. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Let's get it started. I mean, there's an idea. Let's get it started. Let's get started saying, you know what, we're not going to allow kids to go to bed hungry at night. We're not going to allow people to go homeless. We're not going to allow people to go without health care. Let's do some of those things, which I find interesting that John Boehner, Speaker of the House, you know, Mr. GOP himself, has invited the Pope, to come and speak to the Congress. And I just find it amazing that a guy who, in my view, has helped, I'm not going to say single-handedly made poverty worse in our country, but he's helped make poverty much worse and much, much, much more difficult to overcome. He's going to ask the Pope to come and speak. Now, I hope the Pope takes advantage of it so he can chastise the people like Boehner, like Paul Ryan, Mr. If you don't put something in a brown bag, you don't love your children. I mean, stop and think about that one for a second. Really? I mean, the audacity. Here's the reality, though. What we've had for the last, I would argue the last 30 years, but really since the end of the Bush recession, really hyper speed forward. Wages are stagnant and declining. Families are struggling. Poverty's rising, yet corporate profits, you know, as we talked about last night, never better. Things are fantastic. We're allowing these multinationals to park trillions of dollars in these tax-dodging foreign countries. And still, we're handing out billions of dollars of corporate welfare. And I went and had an eye exam today. And this is one of those moments where, it's rare that I get involved in this. But the woman who is doing the fitting of my memory from... It's amazing how far eyeglass technology has come. And here you go, eyeglass technology. That just seems odd to me. But evidently the glasses that I'm getting have memory metal to where you can bend it and twist it and tie it in knots and it will go right back to where it was. Titanium we're making glasses out of now, which just seems really, wow, way out there. But anyway, I'm having this conversation with this woman who, you can tell she's getting by. She's not setting the world on fire, but she's working her behind off and trying to make ends meet. And, saying that, there are these people who abuse the system, and pointing to what she sees in front of her. So she sees people who come in who get a pair of glasses every year. Because I guess, and this is part of, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right policy? Because she claims the program that they have for Medicaid, which I cannot confirm nor deny. I'm taking her word for it solely. I find it difficult to believe that these programs would offer 4 eye exams a year. Find that extraordinarily difficult to believe. And I find it incredibly hard to believe that anyone would want to get 4 eye exams a year. That's just my thought on it. But she claims that this is out there and that people are taking advantage of it. And I guess it's like any program where somebody could be taking advantage of it. And now she's saying that, three-quarters of the people abuse the system, which I find impossible to believe. Because when you start talking to the experts, the people who do these kind of things day in and day out, they put the abuse somewhere in the under 5% range. The vast majority of people use these programs, that the Helping Hand programs, as they're intended. But I find it interesting that here's someone who's somewhere to the bottom half of the economic divide, looking at people behind them, saying, well, they're the reason that everything's all mucked up. Instead of, and now that I have refocused her, maybe she will think a little bit differently, because you could see after our conversation, she didn't know where to go. Her mind was just kind of swimming of, wow, I just. Because I said, you know, I don't really focus so much on that. Look, there are a handful of people who do abuse programs. They do. And even if you put that number at 20-30%, I'm still at this point right now, at this moment, okay with that. Solely because it's good for the economy. The more people who walk through your door who get eye exams, the better it is for you, the better it is for your doctor. It keeps you working, keeps revenue coming through. It's actually a good thing. It's a stimulative thing to make sure that the money gets put into local business. It's good for you. And she goes, well, I never thought of that. I said, now the welfare that I focus on, which when we get rid of my welfare, the welfare that I despise, then you know we'll turn our sights on the other stuff. But the trillions of dollars, and I'm talking trillions with a T, that we hand out to these big multinational corporations, all of this money that we park into their pockets under the guise of, well, they know what to do with it, and they'll stimulate the economy. Have they? I mean, look around. Have they done what we were told they were going to do? All of those tax breaks we've been giving for 30 years, have they created the jobs that we were told they were going to create? The answer? No. Of course you know the answer is no, because we know deep down, we understand, we get. On a very logical level, you give somebody a $20,000 tax break, they're taking a vacation. You give them $20,000 worth of eye exams and people walking through their door, they're going to do more business, they're going to hire more people. That is just common sense. I don't know how you can get any more bottom line than that. So at the end of this conversation, she's saying, wow, I never thought about that, and actually stopped talking about the people behind her. Because she didn't realize that, you know, she's a lot closer to those people than she thinks. And I point to this study put out by the National Women's Law Center, in conjunction with the family, economic security, part of the Women's Family Law Center. They point out, and not surprisingly, that women are 3/4 of the workers in the 10 lowest paid jobs in the country. And that there's this massive wage gap in all of them, and virtually all of them, but three. And they go through the industries that they're talking about, these 10 low wage occupations, which are mostly women, like home health care aides, for instance. 95% of home health care aides are women. Maids and housekeeper, 89%. Personal care assistants, 84%. Cashiers, 72%. Waiters and waitresses, 70% women. The people who prepare your food and do all of that stuff at restaurants, 65% women. Then you get the bartenders, about 58% women. Food prep workers, 56%. Hand packers and packagers. The people who work at your Amazons and your little distribution places, about 49%. And what they found, and not surprising, that 3/4 of these low wage jobs, which are they define under $10.10 an hour, are women. Not surprising. And the share of workers in those 10 largest low waged occupations who are women of color are 37%. They point out that the share of workers in the 10 lowest wage occupations who are mothers of children under 18, about a quarter. So what you've got is you've got these people that you're saying, go get a job, and that we kick them off of welfare, because, you know, you got to have a job, without any child care, without any transportation, any of that stuff. Just you go do it. They are in these low-wage jobs. And I find it interesting that there has been attempts to organize some of these, like the home health care aides. Across the country, there's a push to try and get them union rights. And the right wing in this country has gone ballistic. They have spent huge amounts of money. to try and make sure that they don't get that right. Now, I ask you, because I think home health care aides are one of those godsend positions, one of those people, you know, the wings of angels came in and helped people. Shouldn't we have some dignity and respect for the people who are caring for the least among us so that they're able to care for themselves? And I've talked to a number of these home health aides who have all said the same thing. You know, I'm here taking care of this person, but I can't even take care of myself because I don't have health care. I don't make a decent wage. I don't make a wage where I can take a day off when I'm sick. And I'll tell you, it's something that we're going to have to deal with, and in a big way in the coming years. Because what we're seeing is we're seeing the jaws of the alligator going in opposite directions as the wealth of the consolidation of wealth continues to go up higher and higher into the smaller number of hands. The number of people falling below the poverty line is continuing to go down, down, down. So anybody who's ever taken Economics 101 understands the alligator trap. That at some point that's got to snap back and it's going to bite someone in the behind. In the way of a depression, in the way of mass pain and mass disaster, and maybe I don't know, maybe that's part of what has to happen. I sure hope not. Anyway, that's a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Hillary Tone. Right-wing media outlets were quick to attack President Obama's new plan to alter Labor Department pay requirements to expand the number of salaried workers who qualify for overtime. On Fox & Friends, host Elizabeth Hasper.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the development of our color code of red for Republican and blue for Democrat. Political color coding around the world still remains generally red for liberal leftist parties and conservative parties. And those were also the prevailing designations in America until recently. But game-changing household technology appeared in the 1960s that was all about reds and blues. It was called color television. And yet, for more than 30 years, there was no standard color code. It's during this period that different sources produced different versions of the development of the color scheme. We do know that by the 1996 election, most of the major television networks had gone to red Republicans and blue Democrats. But join us again next time for the clincher. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love?
Well, that was odd. The computer all of a sudden just stopped. Everything just stopped. Everything, the lights went out. Everything just very, very odd. But I guess, you know, when you're dealing with computers, you know, sometimes that happens. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks for listening to The Rick Smith Show. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just weird. Wow. It's going all of a sudden. Everything just went blank. I was going, uh-oh, this is trouble. But fortunately, back up and moving forward. Interesting lawsuit put forth by the good folks of the, I shouldn't say good folks, because these really are not. The people who are the National Right to Work Committee, this legal fund, they actually go around, they look for trouble. These are troublemakers who go around looking for the one disgruntled guy to say, well, let's cause trouble. And they have filed a lawsuit. In the case, and this is one of those weird things where you go, really? This is between Volkswagen of America and the UAW and their workers. This has got nothing to do with an outside group, which I find interesting in this whole scenario that you've got all of these inside interests, or these outside interests going, we want to be involved in this. Doesn't it seem odd to you that all of these politicians and these outside players find this one situation in Tennessee, this one employer, to be such a place that they want to influence and they want to stick their nose into the middle of? It seems very odd to me, and it shouldn't be odd to anyone, because they understand that if organizing begins, it's like a brush fire. It's like a wildfire. Once your neighbor, you start to see your neighbor get a little bit better off, you're going to want that. And I think about when I was a kid, and someone came to me and said, man, when you said that having a union card meant food at the end of the month, completely identified with that. And, you know, I didn't mean it for, you know, it's what it meant to me. When I saw the neighbor, when I saw him get a job working at the Ford factory, and I saw that their lives every week, every month got better and better and better. To me, that sent a very clear message that this is where you want to go. And I find it very interesting that the wealth class of this country have chosen this one plant in Tennessee that, understand, the taxpayers gave $1 billion to bring to the state, that they would have this reaction, this sticking their nose where I don't think it belongs, to be honest with you. These were workers who wanted to organize, and the threats and the intimidation. To be honest, I was shocked the vote was so close. And then you look at exactly what happened down there. Shouldn't have lost it. Just that simple. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Stitcher on the smartphone, iTunes, all of that. Or you can just go to the website, thericksmithshow.com. We've got the player right there. Just click right on it and play as long as you want. Take the program on the go. And as always, you can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Four U.S. postal unions are forming an alliance to defend the Postal Service. The unions, American Postal Workers Union, National Association of Letter Carriers, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, all say the Postal Service is under attack. They say a congressionally manufactured financial crisis is draining the Postal Service of vital resources, and the closing of half the nation's mail processing centers has wiped out tens of thousands of good jobs. The postal unions say that corporate privatizers have the Postal Service in their crosshairs, trying to gain control over large segments of postal operations to get their hands on the U.S. Postal Service's $65 billion in annual revenues. The Postal Union Alliance stands for a public postal service, enhancement and expansion of service, and protection of good union jobs in thousands of communities all over America. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten and teacher union leaders from the UK, Poland, Denmark, and Bulgaria are visiting the Ukraine. The Ukrainian Trade Union of Education and Science Workers invited them. They'll be meeting with Ukraine trade union leaders and government officials. Weingarten says it's a great honor to be asked by Ukraine's teacher unions to work with them to strengthen their democratic institutions and support their efforts to build a brighter future for all Ukrainians through education, democracy, and the rule of law. The battle against New York City's wage theft problem focused Wednesday on El Poblano restaurant, where former employees allege they are owed thousands of dollars in unpaid wages. Some elected officials joined workers and their allies in a rally at the Queens restaurant. Selena Alvarez says she worked at El Poblano in 2012 and was not paid for most of the 10 to 12 hours a day that she worked. She has filed a complaint with the New York State Department of Labor. The restaurant has since shut down. The Coalition to End Wage Theft said the rally is an effort to highlight how challenging it can be for workers to get their lawful pay in these cases. New York State Assembly member Francisco Moya says businesses that don't pay earned wages are no better than thieves. He says some businesses victimize immigrant workers. Unions and community allies have organized to combat what they say is a widespread wage theft problem in New York City. The Teamsters are joining with UK shareholders in the multinational transport company National Express Group, calling on the company's board of directors to improve oversight and transparency regarding the company's human capital policies and practices. The company operates school bus companies Durham in the U.S. and Stock Transportation in Canada. This shareholder proposal is aimed at getting the company to adopt a meaningful and enforceable workplace human rights policy. The Teamsters say worker safety and worker rights need to be ensured at the National Express Group, which employs 35,000 people worldwide.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, the New Hampshire House of Representatives voted in an overwhelming fashion to repeal and abolish their death penalty. The vote 225-104, and it's, you know, it's several emails a couple of days ago that, you know, really questioned my view on it, which is I'm not in favor of state-sanctioned murder. For the folks, and I find it interesting that my friends who are the ones who believe we should be plastering the Ten Commandments everywhere are the ones who want the death penalty the most in my life, in the people that I know, which is very, very odd. Because, you know, there was one of those commandment things in there that they want plastered everywhere. that talks about death. But here to talk a little bit about the death penalty and you know, what we should be doing, I've asked Richard Dieter. He's the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Richard, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, I understand recently, and we hear lots of these stories where someone, you know, 20, 30 years ago was thrown into jail on death row for 20, 30 years, only to find out later that they were nowhere near it. They did nothing. It wasn't them, but they spent the mass of their lives locked up in death row because someone, you know, they looked like somebody who might have done it. And it just seems angering on one vein, but all too frequent on another.
Yeah, there's been 144 people who have been freed from death row with all charges dismissed since 1973. As a matter of fact, there was one additional person on Tuesday in Louisiana, Glenn Ford, who was just the kind of person you just described. And so these cases are still being found.
So, you know, and when I heard about that case, you know, the first thing I thought is, well, I'm glad we didn't kill him. Because they're saying, well, you should be tried. If you're convicted, next day, bullet in the head or whatever. And you go, well, had we done that, because I understand the guy you're talking about, 1984 he was convicted, right?
Yes, so it's 30 years, and he actually came close to an execution date in 1991, and no court in Louisiana or anywhere else ever overturned his conviction. It wasn't like his case was, you know, retried three times. It's only that the prosecution very recently, apparently, got credible evidence that somebody else had committed the crime, and they filed the motion. The courts missed this entirely. They would have executed him.
I can't imagine how this guy must feel, and especially spending 30 years of your life behind bars on death row with people who have killed people, knowing that you're not that guy.
Yeah, you have to have a sense of patience and, I don't know, hope and trust. But what worries me is that there's 3,100 people on death row. People are executed regularly, and among those may be somebody like Glenn Ford, only we may have not learned anything. They just may be executed, and the assumption is that they're guilty, but it's just unfortunate that, you know, no one came through in their case to admit they did it.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, we just saw this, the Department of Justice, Obama's nominee to the Department of Justice, and Debo, I can't pronounce it, Abdigbile, I think it's pronounced.
Yes, Abdigbile, yes.
That, you know, a lot of the conversation around him is he defended someone who is viewed as, who was convicted of killing a cop. And that was, seemed to be the main reason that they didn't, approve his nomination. And do you think that part, because as I look at these cases, these people didn't get the defense that OJ would get. They didn't get the defense that even Jerry Sandusky, the child molester here in Pennsylvania, got. These are folks who got public defenders who have stacks of cases, or attorneys who don't have the time and the expertise to defend these cases. So in a lot of cases, I don't know that they had a chance to start with.
Well, you know, I'm a lawyer, and I also teach law at Catholic University Law School, and the ethical principles that we try to imbue in people is that, you know, our system depends on lawyers defending the unpopular and on taking cases where people, you know, are hated or look very guilty, but they need somebody. That's our adversarial system, and criticizing a lawyer who defends someone who's accused of even a heinous murder is like criticizing a doctor who's treating ill people. You know, we expect them to hang out with the ill, and we expect lawyers to, you know, defend, and defend zealously, as a matter of fact, is what we teach their clients, because that's, our system depends on that for getting the truth out.
Yeah, I mean, just before I went on air tonight, I had a conversation with one of the guys who works here at the station, and he was saying, you know, because one of the attorneys who defended Jerry Sandusky, the guy who was convicted of molesting a bunch of kids here in Pennsylvania, one of his attorneys is in deep trouble and got himself into some hot water. And you know, the guy who works here said, I would have never defended him. I go, well, what if it were you? And, you know, to me, it's that part of our system that I think is so important, because there are cases of, know, this guy sat in jail for 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it was the later lawyers, the trial lawyers, of course, didn't do their job in the case of Glenn Ford there in Louisiana. They weren't criminal lawyers. They were oil and gas people and, you know, had never tried a case before a jury, and they just got appointed because, well, they, you know, they looked up some names, and so they didn't, you know, call the kinds of witnesses, and they didn't defend them zealously. They should have. It may be, you know, now the prosecutor says Glenn Ford should not have even been arrested.
Wow.
Convicted and sentenced to death.
Wow, that's a pretty big sentence. The statement to say he shouldn't even have been arrested. But the sad thing is that this happens a lot. So the question then comes back to this idea of the death penalty, because, you know, I've got some of my chest bumping listeners who, you know, we got to look tough on crime, and Rick, you're not tough enough on criminals. And I don't know that that's true. I'm not thrilled with the idea of state sanctioned murder, and I'm not thrilled with the idea of making a mistake and then realizing, uh-oh, you made a mistake.
And I think it also should be said that no one's talking about letting heinous criminals go if we do away with the death penalty. The alternative now in all states is life without parole. And that, of course, is a harsh sentence. And, you know, in Pennsylvania and throughout the country, that's actually the sentence that is used for most of the crimes that are of that level. It's only the rare case that gets the death penalty, but it's rare in the sense that the person had an extremely bad lawyer, or, you know, that was in a certain county that they used the death penalty a lot, or just didn't have the money to really, you know, make sure he was defended right. It's not the worst that gets the death penalty. It's
the poorest.
Somehow the forgotten few.
I would argue it's the poorest, the people who can't afford F. Lee Bailey and Jerry Sheck.
You won't get the death penalty if you have that kind of... you may get convicted, but you're not going to get the death penalty.
And that's another problem with our system. I mean, justice is supposed to be blind, and maybe it's blind because the attorneys that I can afford compared to, like, who an O.J. could get, completely different. If it were me sitting in judgment of those murders, I'd be sitting behind bars right now.
Yeah, no, you can get convicted of things you didn't do. I mean, not saying you in particular, but an individual it can happen. I've talked to a lot of these people who've been freed. There's a group, Witness for Innocence, Witness to Innocence in Pennsylvania, and they have helped a lot. So, I've gotten to meet these people, and, you know, they say, you know, I hadn't done anything in my life. I just happened to look like this person that did the crime, and I did 10 years on death row, or I, you know, or was almost executed. It's quite amazing. Well, of course, our system isn't going to be perfect. I think the solution is that we take away the infallible punishment or the irrevocable punishment,
right,
which is the death penalty. We're still going to make mistakes, but at least we can undo them with other forms of punishment. But the death penalty, we've executed 1,300 people since 1973. You know, some of them are probably innocent, and that we can prevent.
Yeah. What do you say to those, Richard, who say that it's a deterrent? If, you know, if they know it's out there, they know they're going to get the needle, they're not going to commit these heinous crimes.
Well, I think that presumes a lot of thinking on the part of these criminals who do these things. The crimes I've seen are out of greed, passion, anger, all kinds of things, but not a lot of forethought. And even if someone were to think through this thing, they'd probably say, look, I'm not going to get caught. Or if I get caught, I'm going to wiggle out of the death penalty. Only, you know, 1 out of 100 get that, and there'll be 15 years of appeal. And so, I mean, I think it's somewhat unrealistic to think that criminals go through this kind of calculus. They want something so much that they're willing to kill somebody for it. The death penalty actually kind of puts you on a pedestal. It gives you all kinds of attention, maybe more attention than you've had in your life. Yeah, it's got some bad consequences, but those are far away. They're distant. They're attenuated from the crime. So I don't think that anybody who's looked into this, and I'm talking sociologists, police officers, really believes in this deterrence. You hear the argument, but the sociologists, the scientists who look at this, it just isn't the evidence. We had 39 executions last year in this country. We had over 10,000 murders. There's no connection between those two things. If you commit a murder, you'd have to figure out which county you're in to see whether you're likely to get